Picture this. Okay. You're standing exactly on the border where like three different states meet. You're sweating through this cheap suit. You are juggling two different burner phones, and you're desperately trying to convince a very nice, very gullible woman to wire her life savings into just a completely unregistered, absolute garbage security.
Sounds like a Tuesday for some people.
Right. But here's the question: who actually has the power to stop you? And, more importantly, just how much trouble are you actually in?
Well, it sounds like the climax of a really terrible financial thriller, honestly.
Oh,
But
yeah.
legally, it's the perfect storm. And untangling that storm is it's exactly the key to passing this exam.
Which is exactly what we were doing today. But real quick, before we dive into the wreckage of that whole scenario, just a quick heads up. This deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Yeah, they're great.
They really are. They've got a full Series 65 course with, adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are awaited exactly like the real thing. Check it out at certfuel.com.
Absolutely.
Okay, so let's get into it. You are here today to crush the Series 65 exam, specifically the section on remedies and administrative provisions.
Right. And just for some context, this section represents about four questions on the actual exam, which translates to roughly 2% of your total score.
2%. I mean, that might sound like a rounding error to some people,
Yeah, it
but
does.
if you've ever missed a passing score by 1 point, these are just brutal, agonizing points to lose, especially because they are basically easy points if you just know where the traps are buried.
Oh, exactly. The exam writers love their traps.
They do. So our mission today is to make sure you do not step on a single one of those landmines. But to do that, we can't just sit here and read the dry, dusty legal text of the Uniform Securities
No,
Act.
please no. If we do that, we will both fall asleep. And you will
Perfect.
too.
Exactly. Because the human brain, especially, a brain with ADHD that's studying for a massive licensing exam, it doesn't retain abstract legal theory very well.
Right. It retains stories. It retains cause and effect, humorous situations.
Yes. So we're bringing in a recurring cast of characters to live out these scenarios for you. Throughout this deep dive, you're going to hear about three specific people.
Love these guys.
First, we have Devious Dave.
Classic Dave.
Dave is a shady, corner-cutting broker-dealer agent. He thinks a fiduciary is a type of Italian sports car, and he pretty much treats securities regulations like polite suggestions.
Yeah, Dave is our perpetual bad actor. He's honestly the entire reason the Uniform Securities Act exists in the first
Oh,
place.
he really is. Then we have Administrator Al. Al is the state securities regulator. He is incredibly powerful. He absolutely loves bureaucracy and paperwork, and he is just relentlessly chasing Devious Dave.
You can basically think of Administrator Al as the physical embodiment of the Uniform Securities Act.
Okay, I like that.
Like when we talk about what the state can do, we are literally talking about what Al can do.
Got it. And finally, we have Clueless Kathy. Kathy is well-meaning, but, completely naive.
Bless her heart.
Right. Occasionally she might act as an agent, but usually she's the client. She is the one buying whatever garbage Devious Dave is selling.
The victim, essentially.
Basically. So let's go back to our opening hook. Devious Dave is on that border juggling those burner phones. We need to figure out who actually has jurisdiction over him.
Yeah, and this is the foundational pillar of the entire regulatory framework. Because before Administrator Al can punish Dave, Al has to prove he actually has the legal authority, the jurisdiction, to step in.
Okay, listener, I want you to pause whatever you're doing right now and think about this hypothetical. I am asking you directly.
Listen up.
Devious Dave is sitting in a coffee shop in State A. He picks up his phone and calls Clueless Kathy. Kathy happens to be on a beach vacation in State B.
Thanks for her.
Yeah. So she answers the phone, Dave pitches her the shady stock, and she agrees to buy it. But because Dave uses this weird offshore clearing firm, all the actual paperwork and the money clear in State C.
It is the classic jurisdictional nightmare scenario.
Right. So which state's administrator has jurisdiction to go after Dave? Is it Al in State A, where the call started? Is it Al in State B, where Kathy was sitting? Or is it Al in State C, where the money actually changed hands?
Take a beat, lock in your answer.
Give it a second.
Okay, so the exam writers love this exact scenario because it forces you to understand just how broad the Uniform Securities Act really is.
And the answer.
The answer is that Administrator Al in State A, Administrator Al in State B, and Administrator Al in State C, ALL, have jurisdiction.
Wait,
All of them simultaneously. Yes.
all three states can come after him for one single phone call. That seems, I don't know, like overkill. Walk me through the legal mechanics of how that's even possible.
Okay, so it comes down to a very specific three-pronged rule under the USA.
Okay.
The administrator has jurisdiction over an offer or a sale of a security if the transaction meets any one of three conditions.
Just one.
Just one. The first condition, the offer originated in the state.
Okay, so that covers state A. Dave was drinking his latte and dialed the phone in state A. The action physically started there.
Correct. The second condition, the offer was directed to a person in the state.
Which drags state B into the mix, right? Because the
Yeah.
cell towers directed Dave's voice to Kathy's phone while she was physically sitting on the beach in state B.
Exactly. And the third condition, the offer was accepted in the state.
And there's state C, where the paperwork was finalized and the deal was officially accepted.
You got it.
So because this one sketchy transaction physically touched all three states in different ways, Dave literally just handed three different regulators the authority to investigate him.
He essentially multiplied his legal problems by three.
How?
But this actually brings us to a massive glaring exam trap. And I need everyone listening to highlight this in your mind.
Ooh, okay, trap time.
The exam will try to trick you by introducing a fourth state based entirely on residency.
Ah, okay, let me see if I can construct the trap. So Kathy was just vacationing in state B.
Right.
Let's say her permanent residence, like where she pays her property taxes, where she's registered to vote, and where her driver's license is issued. Let's say that is state D.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Yes, the exam question will give you all those juicy details about state D to make it sound incredibly official and important.
Right.
They want you to assume that state D must step in to protect its own citizen.
So, does state D have jurisdiction?
State D has absolutely zero jurisdiction over this specific transaction. None.
Wait, but she's a resident. Administrator Al in state D is supposed to protect the people of state D, isn't it?
He protects the people acting within the borders of state D. The Uniform Securities Act is concerned with the physical location of the offer and the acceptance, not the permanent address of the victim.
Okay.
Did the offer originate in state D? No. Was it directed to state D? No. It went to her vacation spot in state B. Was it accepted in state D? No. Therefore, state D has no legal standing.
That is fascinating. So the jurisdiction is tied to the physical geography of the trade, not like the zip code on the client's tax return.
Exactly.
That makes sense when you spell it out, but it is totally counterintuitive if you just naturally think regulators protect residents. You have to retrain your brain to think regulators protect the geography of the transaction.
That is the perfect way to frame it. Geography over residency.
Yeah.
And once Administrator Al establishes that the geography falls under his domain, the amount of power he wields is just staggering.
Yeah, I was looking through the source material on the administrator's powers, and I was genuinely shocked. Al operates with a level of authority that feels almost unconstitutional if you don't really understand the
Oh,
context.
for sure.
For instance, he can conduct public or private investigations anytime, anywhere, even outside his own state.
Yes, if the jurisdiction is established, his investigative reach is incredibly long.
He doesn't even need a public complaint to start snooping. Like, if Al just has a bad feeling about Devious Dave, he can just open an investigation.
That's right.
He doesn't need to ask a judge for permission. He doesn't even have to tell Dave that he's being investigated.
The administrator has incredibly broad discretion to determine whether any person has violated or is about to violate any provision of the act. Notice that phrase. Is about to violate.
He can act preemptively. That's wild.
He can publish information about Dave's violations to warn the public. He can administer oaths.
But the one that really stopped me in my tracks was the books and records thing.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me if I am reading this wrong. Administrator Al can examine the books and records of any registered person, like Devious Dave or his broker-dealer firm, at any time without a warrant.
You are reading it perfectly correctly. No warrant is required.
How does that not violate the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable searches? Like, if the police want to search my house, they need to convince a judge to give them a piece of paper. Why can Al just walk into Dave's office and demand his hard drives?
Because participating in the securities industry is not a fundamental human right. It is a highly regulated privilege. When Devious Days, or his broker-dealer firm, filled out their application to register in that state, they signed an agreement. By registering, you are implicitly and legally agreeing to this level of oversight.
Oh, I see.
You are saying, in exchange for the privilege of making money off the public in this state, I agree to open my books to the regulator whenever they ask.
So Dave essentially waived his right to demand a warrant the moment he got his license.
Exactly. It's just a condition of doing business.
Okay, but this is where we really have to draw a hard line in the sand, because the exam is going to test the absolute limits of Al's power.
Yes, they will.
Because he is not a king.
Uh-huh.
There is a very strict boundary between what Administrator Al can do as a regulator and what only a court of law can do.
This side-by-side comparison is arguably the most heavily tested concept in this entire unit. You have to mentally separate Administrator Al, who is a quasi-judicial regulatory authority, from an actual judge in a black robe sitting in a court of law.
Let's run a drill on this. I'm going to throw out an action. And you tell me if Al can do it on his own, or if he has to go cry to a judge to get it done.
Let's do it.
First up, issuing a subpoena to compel a witness to show up and testify.
Al can do that entirely on his own. He can issue subpoenas for testimony and for documents.
What about issuing a cease and desist order, like telling Dave to immediately stop selling a specific toxic mutual fund?
Al can issue a cease and desist order on his own authority.
Yeah.
And crucially, he can do it with or without a prior hearing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He doesn't have to invite Dave in for a chat first. If he sees imminent harm to the public, he just issues the order. Stop immediately.
Okay, what about issuing an injunction?
Stop right there. Administrator Al cannot issue an injunction. Only a court can issue an injunction.
Wait, what is the practical difference between a cease and desist and an injunction? Don't they both just mean stop doing that?
Well, let's use an analogy here. Administrator Al is basically a mall cop.
Okay, a mall cop.
A very powerful mall cop, but a mall cop nonetheless. He has a really loud whistle.
Yeah.
When he issues a cease and desist, that is the mall cop blowing his whistle and yelling, stop running by the fountain.
Right. It's a regulatory command.
But what happens if Devious Dave ignores the mall cop? The mall cop cannot tackle him. The mall cop doesn't have handcuffs. The mall cop have to call the actual police and go to the actual legal system.
And the legal system is the court.
Exactly. An injunction is a court order compelling behavior. It carries the full weight of the judicial system. If you violate a cease and desist, you are just ignoring a regulator. But if you violate an injunction, you are in contempt of court, and men with guns can come physically put you in a cage.
So administrator equals cease and desist. Court equals injunction. If a test question asks who has the authority to grant an injunction, the answer is never the administrator. It is always the court.
Always. Let's do a few more. Can Al send Dave to jail?
Well, following the mall cop logic, no. Only a judge can sentence someone to prison.
Correct. Can Al make a formal legal determination that Dave has committed fraud?
I would assume no, because finding someone guilty of a crime requires a trial, not just a regulator's opinion.
Spot on. Only a judge makes judicial determinations of fraud. How about this one? Can Al force Dave to give Kathy her money back? Like, can he order restitution?
Ooh, that's tricky. Al regulates the money, so maybe he can order a refund.
He cannot.
Really?
Al cannot order restitution. He cannot order disgorgement of ill-gotten gains. And he cannot appoint a receiver to take over Dave's assets. Those are all forms of equitable or monetary relief. Then they require a judge.
That is such a vital distinction. Al has the whistle. The court has the teeth. Al can ban you from the mall by revoking your license. But if he wants your money or your freedom, he needs a judge.
That framing will save you on at least two exam questions, guaranteed.
So let's push this scenario forward a bit. Administrator Al knows Dave is up to something. Al uses his administrative power to issue a subpoena. He demands Dave's emails, his client lists, and orders Dave to appear at his office on Tuesday at 9 a.m. for questioning. Okay. Tuesday at 9 a.m. rolls around, and Dave just doesn't show up. He's sitting on his couch, ignoring the subpoena. What happens now?
This brings us to a very specific, somewhat archaic vocabulary word that you absolutely must know for the exam.
What's the word?
Contumacy.
Contumacy. C-O-N-T-U-M-A-C-Y. It sounds like a medieval disease.
It does, but it's a legal noun. The adjective form is being contumacious. It simply means willfully and stubbornly disobeying a subpoena.
Willfully.
Yeah. Dave didn't oversleep. His car didn't break down. He is actively, intentionally, flipping the bird to the administrator's legal request.
Okay, so Dave is being contumacious. But since we just established Al is a mall cop with a whistle, Al cannot drive over to Dave's house, kick the door down, and drag him to the hearing.
Right. Al has no arrest powers. Yep. So when Dave commits contumacy, Al has to take his ignored subpoena, walk down to the local courthouse, and file a petition with the judge.
Got it.
Al essentially says, Your Honor, I have jurisdiction. I issued a lawful subpoena, and this agent is ignoring it.
And the judge backs him up.
The court will issue its own order, compelling Dave to comply with Al's original subpoena. The court is essentially saying, the regulator asked nicely. Now we are telling you legally.
Let's say Dave is truly reckless. He ignores the judge's order too.
Well, now he's crossed a massive line. If he ignores the court order, the court will find Dave in contempt of court.
And contempt of court is where the teeth come out.
Yeah.
That can result in massive fines, or the judge can literally throw Dave in a jail cell until he decides to cooperate.
Exactly. You do not mess with contempt of court. So realistically, Dave's lawyer is going to tell him, you have to go to Al's office and sit in the chair.
Okay, so Dave shows up. He's in the interrogation room. Al slides a microphone across the table and starts asking about the unregistered securities he sold to Clueless Kathy.
Setting the scene.
Dave has watched a lot of police procedurals on TV. Can Dave just cross his arms, lean back, and say, I plead the fifth. I refuse to answer on the grounds that it may incriminate me. Let's give the listener a beat. Think about it. Can you plead the fifth in an administrative hearing under the Uniform Securities Act?
The answer is no. Under the USA, no person is excused from attending, testifying, or producing records on the grounds that the testimony might tend to incriminate them.
Wait, hold on. The Fifth Amendment is a foundational constitutional right. How can a state's securities law just bypass the Constitution? That doesn't make any sense.
They aren't bypassing it. They are negotiating a trade. The state recognizes your right against self-incrimination. However, the state's interest in protecting the public from financial fraud is so high that they compel you to speak anyway.
Okay.
But to make it constitutional, if Administrator Al forces Dave to testify over Dave's Fifth Amendment objection, the state must grant Dave immunity in exchange for his words.
Okay, a trade. You give up your silence, we give you immunity. But what kind of immunity? Because I know there are different levels.
This is a critical detail. The Uniform Securities Act specifically provides for transactional immunity.
Transactional immunity. Break that down for me.
Transactional immunity is the strongest form of immunity. It means Dave cannot be prosecuted for the underlying transaction or crime that he is being forced to confess to. He is entirely immune from criminal prosecution for that specific act.
So the slate is wiped clean.
Exactly. Regarding criminal charges for whatever he admits to.
That seems like a massive loophole for Dave. So Al forces Dave to talk. Dave completely spills his guts. Yes, I sold fake bonds to Kathy. I forged the documents. I stole the money. And because he was forced to say it, Dave can't go to jail for the fake bonds.
For criminal charges, yes, he is protected.
Wow.
Compare that to use immunity, which is much weaker. Use immunity just means the prosecutor can't use Dave's specific words from the hearing against him in court. But if they find other evidence, like an email, they can still lock him up.
Oh, okay.
The USA grants the stronger transactional immunity.
Wow. So Dave confesses, and he gets to walk out of there a free man.
A free man, yes, but not an employed man.
Let me guess.
Remember the difference between criminal, civil, and administrative actions. Transactional immunity only protects Dave from going to state prison. Administrator Al can absolutely still use that forced confession to permanently revoke Dave's securities license.
Of course.
And Kathy can still use that confession to sue him in civil court for every penny he has. Immunity keeps you out of a cell. It does not keep you in the industry.
That is a brilliant clarification. You trade your right to silence to save your liberty, but your career is still dead. Now, let's flag a huge trap right here. Listener, pay attention. This is where the exam tries to get you.
Listen closely.
Let's say Dave is forced to testify. He knows he has transactional immunity, so he figures, I'm bulletproof. Al asks him about Kathy's money, and Dave flat out lies under oath. He completely fabricates a story. Does his transactional immunity protect him from being charged with perjury?
Absolutely not. And you will almost certainly see a question phrased exactly like that.
So he's busted.
Yes. Immunity protects you from the past crime you are confessing to. It does not protect you from the new crime of lying about it under oath. If Dave commits perjury or contempt while sitting in that chair, his immunity shield is useless against those new offenses. He will be prosecuted for perjury.
Okay, so Dave is trapped. He didn't lie. He confessed. He kept his freedom. But Al has everything he needs to destroy Dave's career. Which brings us to the next phase. Laying the smackdown.
My favorite part.
We're talking about Administrator Al's ultimate unilateral weapon denying, suspending, or revoking a registration.
This is the heavy artillery of administrative law. Revocation permanently terminates Dave's ability to operate in the securities industry in that state. And as we established with the mall cop analogy, Al doesn't need a judge to do this.
Right.
But because revoking someone's livelihood is such a massive exercise of state power, the law places a very strict mandatory hurdle in front of Al. It's called the two-prong test.
The two-prong test. If you take nothing else away from this section, memorize this test. To drop the hammer on Dave's registration, Administrator Al must meet two distinct conditions simultaneously. Prong one, the action must be in the public interest. Prong two, there must be a specific statutory ground found in the USA.
Both conditions must be present. You cannot revoke a license with only one prong.
Let's test the logic here. Let's say Administrator Al just personally hates Devious Dave.
I mean, who doesn't?
Fair. Let's say Dave has a genuinely obnoxious haircut. He talks too loudly at restaurants, and Al just finds him repulsive. Al thinks, it is absolutely in the public interest that the good people of my state do not have to look at this guy's haircut while discussing their retirement. Can Al revoke his license based on that?
Even if we agree the haircut is a threat to the public interest meeting prong, one Al is completely missing prong two. There must be a specific statutory ground.
Right.
You can scour the Uniform Securities Act all day, and you will not find a clause that says having an obnoxious haircut is a ground for revocation. Therefore, Al cannot touch his license.
Okay, let's flip it around then. Let's say Dave makes a clerical error. He forgets to pay his annual $50 registration renewal filing fee. The law explicitly states that failing to pay the fee is a statutory ground for discipline. So prong two is met. Can Al instantly permanently revoke Dave's license?
He cannot instantly revoke it without justifying prong one. Is it in the public interest to permanently ban a financial professional from the industry forever, destroying his career, simply because a $50 check got lost in the mail one time?
Probably not.
Almost certainly not. The administrator has to find that both a technical violation occurred, ADD, that removing this person serves to protect the public from harm.
So it's a balance. You need the technical rule broken, and you need a philosophical justification that the punishment protects society.
Exactly.
Let's dig into these specific statutory grounds, the technical rules that make up Pong 2, because the list is extensive, and some of them are incredibly tricky. I want to look at what I call the 10-year crime trap.
This one is huge.
Listener, I am asking you a direct question. Listen closely to the difference between these two scenarios. Scenario A, Devious Dave was convicted of a felony DUI 9 years ago.
Okay.
Scenario B, Dave has a misdemeanor conviction for shoplifting a candy bar from a gas station 2 years ago. Which of these, the 9-year-old felony or the 2-year-old misdemeanor, is grounds for Administrator Al to deny his registration?
Think about it.
Take a beat.
This is a classic, highly testable trap that preys on your moral assumptions. You have to separate how the law treats felonies versus misdemeanors.
What's the rule?
The rule is this. Any felony conviction within the past 10 years is a statutory ground for denial or revocation, period.
Wait, any felony? It doesn't have to be a financial crime.
It is not. It does not matter if it was a securities fraud, an assault, or a felony DUI. The logic is that a felony is a severe breach of society's rules. If you have committed a crime severe enough to be classified as a felony in the last decade, the state does not trust you to manage other people's life savings.
Wow.
So Dave's felony DUI from 9 years ago, that is an absolute statutory ground for denial.
Okay, so the felony counts. What about the misdemeanor? Shoplifting the candy bar was much more recent, only 2 years ago, and it's technically theft.
For misdemeanors, the rule is entirely different and much narrower. It must be a misdemeanor involving a security or the securities business, and it must be within the last 10 years.
So a candy bar from a gas station
has absolutely nothing to do with the securities business. Therefore, it is not a statutory ground for denial. Al cannot use it against him.
But let me change the facts. What if Dave's misdemeanor was for petty theft, but the specific act was that he stole $50 out of Clueless Kathy's purse while she was in the bathroom during a portfolio review?
Ah, now the context shifts. The conviction is still just a misdemeanor for petty theft, but the underlying act involved a client relationship and occurred during the course of the securities business.
Right.
In that specific case, yes, it would be grounds for denial.
It's all about assessing their fitness for this specific industry. A felony shows a massive lapse in general judgment. A misdemeanor only matters if it shows you specifically cannot be trusted around client money.
That is the exact philosophy behind the rule.
Okay, let's explore a few more grounds for discipline. What if Dave is just completely broke? The source material says insolvency is a ground for revocation, meaning if Dave's liabilities exceed his assets, or he cannot meet his obligations as they mature, Al can take his license. Why is being bad at your own personal finance a reason to lose your job?
Think about the psychological pressure. If a financial professional is personally bankrupt, facing foreclosure, and desperate for cash, the temptation to dip into a client's funds or to churn an account to generate commissions becomes astronomically high.
That makes sense.
Yeah, the administrator isn't necessarily punishing them for being poor. The administrator is removing an immense risk to the public interest. Insolvency is a red flashing light for future fraud.
That makes perfect, if slightly brutal, sense. Mm-hmm. Let's look at one more ground. Not qualified on the basis of training, experience, and knowledge. Obviously, if Dave doesn't know what a stock is, he shouldn't be selling them. But the exam loves to test a specific caveat regarding the word experience.
Yes. The Uniform Securities Act explicitly states that lack of experience alone cannot be the sole basis for denial if the applicant is otherwise qualified by training or knowledge.
Explain that for the listener who might be taking this exam to get their very first job in finance.
So if you're 22 years old, straight out of college, you have exactly 0 years of experience in the securities industry. But you studied the material, you passed your Series 65 exam, and you underwent the training program at your new firm.
You put in the work.
Right. You have the knowledge. Administrator Al cannot reject your registration application simply by saying you don't have enough years under your belt. Everyone has to start somewhere. As long as you have the training, lack of experience is not a disqualifier.
That is a relief for everyone listening. You can't be barred just for being the new kid. All right, let's move into the mechanics of time.
Time limits.
Yeah. Section 4 on our conceptual outline. The clock is ticking. Administrator Al has a lot of power, but he doesn't have unlimited time to use it. Let's start with the 30-day rule for pre-registration facts.
This one requires some mental gymnastics, so let's walk through it slowly. The rule is designed to force the administrator to act efficiently.
Okay.
It states, if the administrator knew facts about an applicant before their registration became effective, the administrator only has 30 days after the effective date to bring a disciplinary proceeding based solely on those facts.
Okay, let's put Dave and Al in a scenario. Dave submits his application to register in Al's state on January 1st. Administrator Al starts reviewing the file.
Standard process.
On January 15th, Al discovers that Dave had his securities license revoked in a foreign country 3 years ago. This is a massive red flag, a clear statutory ground for denial. But Al's office is understaffed. He gets distracted by a different case, and he completely forgets to act on it. Because nobody stopped it, Dave's registration automatically becomes effective on January 30th.
Right. Dave is now legally registered. So the 30-day clock starts ticking on January 30th, the effective date.
Okay.
Because Al actually knew about the foreign revocation before the effective date, Al only has 30 days from January 30th, meaning until March 1st, to initiate a proceeding against Dave based solely on that foreign revocation.
So if Al wakes up in a cold sweat on day 40, let's say March 15th, and says, yeah, oh man, I forgot to deny devious Dave for that foreign action, Dave is safe.
Dave is safe from being disciplined solely for that specific pre-existing fact. The 30-day window closed. Al missed his chance to use that specific weapon.
But let me change the timeline to test the boundaries.
Yeah.
What if Dave successfully hides his past?
Always a possibility with Dave.
Right. His registration goes effective on January 30th, and Al has absolutely no idea about the foreign revocation. Then, months later, on July 1st, Al receives an anonymous tip and discovers Dave's dark secret. Does Al only have 30 days from July 1st to act?
You fell right into the trap. The answer is no, and this is exactly how the exam will test it.
Why not?
The key word is discovers. The 30-day limit only applies to facts Al actually knew before the registration went effective. If Al discovers the dark secret after Dave is already registered, the 30-day rule does not apply at all. There is no ticking clock.
Yeah.
Al can bring the hammer down immediately or 3 months later whenever he builds the case.
I see. The time bar only punishes the administrator for sitting on information he already had. It doesn't reward the applicant for successfully hiding a crime. Known before registration equals 30-day limit. Discovered after registration equals no limit.
Precisely. Now let's look at another timing scenario involving withdrawal.
Okay, Dave realizes Al is finally onto him. Dave committed fraud. He knows Al is building a bulletproof case, and Dave decides to employ a bold strategy. You can't fire me if I quit.
Bold strategy, Cotton.
Right. Dave sends in a formal withdrawal of his registration, packs a suitcase, and books a one-way flight to a deserted island. He wants to voluntarily exit the industry before Al can revoke his license because a revocation is a permanent black mark on his record nationwide.
It's a clever attempt to game the system. But the authors of the Uniform Securities Act anticipated this exact move.
Of course they did.
Withdrawal registration is a voluntary act by the professional, and it normally takes 30 days to become effective. View T, and this is the massive caveat, the administrator retains jurisdiction to institute disciplinary proceedings for one full year after the withdrawal becomes effective.
Wait, so Dave can turn in his badge, fly to Fiji, and sit on the beach drinking out of a coconut for 11 months, and Administrator L can still officially convene a hearing, present the evidence, and revoke Dave's registration on the public record.
He absolutely can. Dave can book the flight, but Al's jurisdiction is in his suitcase for a full year. Dave cannot just vanish to escape punishment. The state needs that one-year tail to ensure bad actors get that permanent black mark on their central registration depository record, preventing them from just popping up in another state 2 years later.
Okay, that makes sense. But how does withdrawal contrast with cancellation? Because in everyday conversational English, withdrawing your license and canceling your license sound like the exact same thing. I don't have a license anymore.
On the exam, they are fundamentally different concepts with different triggers. Withdrawal is initiated by the person. Dave says, "I want out." Cancellation, on the other hand, is initiated by the administrator. And crucially, it is non-disciplinary.
Non-disciplinary. So why would Al cancel a registration if he isn't punishing someone?
Al cancels a registration for administrative housekeeping. He is just cleaning up the database. Cancellation happens if the administrator determines that Devious Dave has literally died, or if Dave had been declared mentally incompetent by a court.
Oh, I see.
Or if Dave's broker-dealer firm simply ceases to do business and shuts its doors. Or if the administrator simply cannot locate Dave after a reasonable search.
Ah, so revocation is the punishment. You were bad, you are banned. Cancellation is just acknowledging reality. Dave is dead. Cancel his license so the database is accurate.
Exactly. And because it is non-disciplinary, a cancellation carries no prejudice against future re-registration. Assuming, of course, the cancellation was due to a cannot-be-located situation and the person eventually turns up, they aren't banned from reapplying.
Right. Okay, last part of the timing section, summary actions. We said earlier that Al has a lot of power, but he has to meet the two-prong test to revoke a license.
Yes.
Sometimes, though, Al doesn't have time to build a massive case. He sees Dave doing something incredibly destructive to client accounts right now, and he needs to stop Dave immediately. We know Al can issue a cease and desist without a hearing, but can he summarily suspend Dave's actual license without a hearing?
Yes, he can. This is the emergency break. The administrator may, by order, summarily postpone or suspend a registration pending final determination of any proceeding. It is a temporary, immediate freeze on Dave's ability to work.
But what about due process? The government can't just take away someone's livelihood indefinitely without letting them defend themselves in a hearing, right?
They cannot do it indefinitely.
Oh.
Which is why due process kicks in immediately after the summary suspension is ordered. The moment Al drops that summary suspension, he must promptly notify Dave and Dave's employer that the order has been entered and state the reasons why.
And Dave can demand a hearing.
Yes. And here is the heavily tested number you must memorize. If Dave requests a hearing in writing, Administrator Al must set the matter down for a hearing within 15 days of receiving the request.
15 days. That is a very fast turnaround in the legal world.
It has to be fast, because Dave is currently legally barred from earning a living. The state has to justify their emergency action quickly. But if Dave does not request a hearing and Al doesn't order one, that temporary summary order just remains in effect indefinitely until it is modified or vacated.
Let's lock that in. Summary action against a person, written request by the person, hearing must be held in 15 days. Okay, take a breath.
Whew.
We are doing great. Let's shift our focus. Up until now, we have talked almost exclusively about people. Agents, broker-dealers, Devious Dave trying to save his license. Let's pivot and talk about the actual products being sold.
Right. Administrator Al doesn't just regulate the humans. He regulates the securities themselves. And his primary tool for policing securities is called a stop order.
A stop order. So this is denying, suspending, or revoking the effectiveness of a securities registration statement rather than a person's professional license.
Exactly. If a company tries to register a new stock to sell to the public in Al's state, and Al realizes the offering is a complete scam, he issues a stop order to block the security from being legally sold.
What are the rules for issuing a stop order? Does he need a judge?
The mechanics are remarkably similar to revoking a person. To issue a stop order against a security, Al must use the exact same two-prong test we discussed earlier.
Let's review it. Prong one, It must be in the public interest. Prong two, there must be a specific statutory ground.
Stud on. So if Devious Dave's new startup tries to register a stock offering, and Al discovers that the offering circular is wildly misleading and would work a fraud upon the purchasers, that constitutes a statutory ground. And stopping it is obviously in the public interest. Bam, stop order. The security cannot be sold.
And does that 30-day retroactive limit apply here too? The one where if Al knew something before it went effective, he only has 30 days to act?
Yes, it applies here in the exact same way. If Al knew the offering was flawed, but let it become effective anyway, he only has a 30-day window after the effective date to issue a stop order based solely on those facts. He can't sit on his hands.
Okay, here is where this gets incredibly interesting. And we enter the realm of federal versus state power. Let's talk about federal preemption. Listen closely to this scenario. Devious Dave is tired of being chased by Administrator Al. Dave cleans up his act just enough to get a massive promotion.
Good for Dave.
He leaves his shady little state-level broker-dealer and gets hired by a gargantuan trillion-dollar SEC-registered federal-covered investment advisor firm. He's playing in the federal big leagues now. Now, let's say Dave's new firm does something Al doesn't like. Can Administrator Al revoke Dave's new firm's registration?
No. Administrator Al is completely blocked from doing that.
Really? Al, the all-powerful state regulator who doesn't even need a warrant, has no power here.
His regulatory powers are preempted by federal law. Specifically, a law passed in 1996 called the National Securities Markets Improvement Act, or NSMIA.
NSMIA. Why did Congress feel the need to pass that?
You have to imagine the chaos before 1996. You had massive national investment firms trying to operate across the country, and they had to comply with 50 different state administrators, all with 50 different sets of rules, 50 different financial requirements, and 50 different record-keeping standards.
That sounds like a nightmare.
It was incredibly inefficient. So Congress drew a hard line to stop state and federal regulators from stepping on each other's toes.
So what did NSMIA actually do?
NSMIA essentially said that if an investment advisor is large enough to be federal covered, meaning they manage massive amounts of money and are registered directly with the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, then the state administrators cannot require them to register at the state level as well.
And if they aren't registered with Al, Al can't revoke a registration that doesn't exist.
Exactly. Al cannot suspend their SEC registration. He cannot enforce state-level record-keeping rules that exceed the SEC's rules. He cannot demand they meet state-level minimum net worth requirements.
Wow.
The firm answers to the federal government, not to the local mall cop. To use an analogy, the SEC is the FBI. Administrator Al is the local town sheriff. NSMIA is the yellow jurisdictional tape that the FBI puts up around a crime scene. The local sheriff is not allowed to cross that tape and tell the FBI how to run their investigation.
I love that analogy. The FBI and the town sheriff. But wait, does that mean a federal covered advisor can just run rampant in L's state? What if Dave, sitting at his new fancy SEC registered desk, starts committing massive, egregious fraud against the citizens of L's state? Is Al forced to just stand behind the yellow tape and watch?
Absolutely not. And this is the critical nuance you must understand, because the exam will test your understanding of this limit.
Okay, what's the limit?
NSMIA preempts state registration and regulatory housekeeping, but it does not preempt state anti-fraud enforcement.
Okay, unpack that. How does the sheriff get past the FBI's tape?
The law essentially says, we won't make you do duplicate paperwork, but we will not allow you to commit crimes in our backyard. Even if Dave works for a federal-covered firm, Administrator Al still has claws. He can require the federal firm to file a notice filing in the state, which is basically just paying a fee and letting Al know they are operating there. But most importantly, if Dave commits actual fraud, Al retains 100% full anti-fraud jurisdiction. Al can investigate Dave, he can subpoena Dave, he can issue cease and desist orders against Dave, and he can seek court injunctions against Dave for fraud, regardless of whether the firm is state or federal.
That is such a vital distinction. Fraud is fraud. It's like diplomatic immunity. A foreign diplomat might not have to get a state driver's license to drive in your city, but if they get drunk and run over a pedestrian, the local police are still going to detain them. You are exempt from the paperwork, but you are never exempt from the anti-fraud statutes.
That is a very visceral way to put it, but legally it tracks perfectly. The state administrator always retains jurisdiction over fraudulent acts committed within their borders.
Okay, so Al catches Dave committing fraud, and Al uses his anti-fraud powers to revoke whatever state-level agent licenses Dave still has. Al has done his job. He protected the future public, but this leads us to section 6 of our journey, making the victim whole. We need to talk about civil liability. Because revoking Day's license is great for society, but clueless Kathy already lost her entire life savings buying Dave's unregistered fraudulent garbage stock. She doesn't just want Dave fired, she wants her money back.
This is where we leave the realm of administrative law regulators punishing rule breakers and enter the realm of civil liability citizens suing each other for damages. The Uniform Securities Act has a robust civil liability provision designed specifically to make victims like Kathy whole again.
So Kathy hires a bulldog lawyer and sues devious Dave. But let's look at reality. Dave is a sleazeball. He spent all of Kathy's money on cheap suits, burner phones, and bad sports cars. He is broke.
Classic Dave.
If Kathy wins a lawsuit against Dave, she just gets a piece of paper saying a broke guy owes her money. Is she just out of luck?
She would be, except the Uniform Securities Act includes a concept called joint and several liability. This is a massive advantage for the plaintiff, Kathy.
Joint and several liability, how does it help her?
It means she doesn't just have to sue devious Dave. She casts a much wider net. She can sue Dave. She can also sue Dave's broker-dealer firm. She can sue the partners, officers, or directors of that firm. She can even sue any other employee who materially aided Dave in making the fraudulent sale.
So she sues the entire corporate ladder.
Exactly. Joint and several means that all of these parties are collectively responsible for the entire amount of damages, but they're also individually responsible for the whole amount.
Okay, explain that.
If the court awards Kathy $100,000, she doesn't have to collect $10,000 from 10 different people. She can collect the entire $100,000 judgment from whichever single defendant happens to have the deepest pockets.
Which is almost always going to be the broker-dealer firm.
Precisely. It incentivizes the firm to police their own agents, because if an agent goes rogue, the firm pays the bill.
But wait, is there a defense for the firm? Can Dave's boss go into court and say, "Your Honor, Dave is a rogue agent. He hid this from us. I had absolutely no idea he was selling this garbage to Kathy."
That is a valid defense, but it's a very high bar to clear. The legal defense is that the controlling person did not know, and in the exercise of reasonable care, could not have known that the violation was occurring.
Ah, reasonable care. That is the catch.
Exactly. If the firm had terrible compliance procedures, if they never audited Dave's emails, if they ignored red flags, they failed the reasonable care test, ignorance is only a defense if you are actively trying to monitor them and they still slip past you. If you just closed your eyes, you are liable.
Okay, so Kathy successfully sues Dave and his firm. Let's look at the math. The buyer's damages formula. I don't want to get bogged down in algebra, but the exam expects you to understand the logic of what Kathy is owed.
The underlying philosophy is simple. Restore Kathy to the exact financial position she would have been in if she had never met devious Dave. The law is not a lottery ticket. She doesn't get a windfall. She just gets made whole. No more, no less.
Okay.
There are two scenarios we need to look at. Scenario A, Kathy still owns the garbage security.
Okay, so the worthless stock certificates are physically sitting on her kitchen table.
Right. To get her money back, she must tender the security back, meaning she legally hands the certificates back to Dave or the court. In return, the formula dictates she receives her original purchase price, PLUS interest, from the date of the sale, which is often called the legal rate of interest, minus any income or dividends she happened to receive from the security while she held it.
Walk me through why we subtract the dividends. That seems mean to the victim.
Let's use real numbers. Kathy bought the fraudulent stock for $10,000. While she held it for a year, the stock surprisingly paid out a $500 dividend before completely collapsing.
Okay.
When she sues, she wants her $10,000 back, plus let's say $500 interest for the time her money was tied up. But she already received $500 in cash from the dividend.
Right.
If the court gave her the full $10,500, plus she kept the $500 dividend, she would end up with $11,000. She would have made a profit off a rescinded trade.
And the law says no double dipping.
Exactly. The formula subtracts the $500 dividend from her damages, bringing her award down to $10,000, which exactly matches her original position. She is made perfectly whole.
That makes perfect sense. Now, what about scenario B? What if Kathy realized it was a scam 6 months ago and she panic sold the stock at a massive loss just to salvage some cash? She doesn't have the certificates to hand back to Dave.
The formula adjusts to accommodate that. She gets her original purchase price, PLS interest, minus any income received, minus the value of the security when she sold it, minus interest on that sole value from the date she disposed of it.
Let's stick with the numbers. She bought for $10,000. It paid no dividends. She panicked and sold it to a third party for $2,000. She is out $8,000.
So Dave owes her the original $10,000 minus the $2,000 she already recovered by selling it, which equals $8,000. Plus, Dave owes her interest on the $10,000 up until the day she sold it, and interest on the $8,000 difference from the day she sold it until the day of the court judgment.
Again, logic prevails. The math is just a mechanism to calculate the exact distance back to zero.
Exactly.
Now, here is where we need to throw up some massive caution tape. Listener, sit up. We need to talk about the statute of limitations for these civil suits.
This is one of the most common exam traps. The statute of limitations for a civil suit under the Uniform Securities Act is a two-part test.
Okay, what is it?
The time limit is 3 years from the date of the sale, or 2 years from the date of discovery of the fraud.
3 years from sale, 2 years from discovery. But here is the critical, bold, underlined part that you must burn into your memory, whichever comes first.
Whichever comes first. That is the phrase that determines the outcome. The earliest deadline controls the situation.
Okay, listener, I am testing you. Think through this scenario. Clueless Kathy buys the unregistered stock from Dave on January 1st, 2020. 3.5 years go by. She never looks at her statements.
Poor Kathy.
It is now June 1st, 2023. Kathy opens a letter, talks to an accountant, and suddenly discovers, oh my gosh, this entire investment was a massive fraud. She just discovered it today. Does she have 2 years from today to sue Dave?
Does she?
Take a beat. Does she have 2 years?
It is so tempting to say yes, but the answer is no. She is completely out of luck.
But wait, the rule explicitly says she gets 2 years from the date of discovery. She just discovered it.
You fell right into the trap. Read the whole rule. It says 3 years from the sale or 2 years from discovery, whichever comes first.
Oh.
3 years from the date of sale was January 1st, 2023. That hard deadline expired 6 months ago. Because a three-year deadline already passed, her two-year discovery window is entirely irrelevant. The earliest deadline came and went. She is time-barred from bringing a civil suit.
Wow, that is devastating for Kathy. But I guess from a systemic perspective, it is designed to ensure legal finality. You can't have the threat of a lawsuit hanging over a broker's balance sheet for 40 years just because a client never bothered to read their mail.
Exactly. Markets require certainty. Let's flip the scenario to show how the two-year rule does apply.
Okay.
Kathy buys the stock on January 1st, 2020. 6 months later, on July 1st, 2020, she discovers it is a fraud. The three-year overall clock still has 2.5 years left on it, but the two-year discovery clock just started. Which deadline comes first?
Well, the two-year discovery clock will expire on July 1st, 2022. The three-year sale clock doesn't expire until January 1st, 2023, so the two-year clock hits first.
Correct. So she only has 2 years from that discovery day to sue, even though she is technically well within the three-year overall limit, whichever comes first.
Write it on your hand before you walk into the testing center, whichever comes first.
Yep.
Okay, let's look at one more civil trap, the rescission offer. Let's say Dave realizes Kathy is onto him. He knows she's talking to a lawyer. Dave panics.
As he should.
He knows if she sues him in court, she is going to win. And on top of paying her back, the judge is going to make Dave pay court costs and her attorney's fees. So Dave tries to cut his losses and avoid court entirely. He sends Kathy a formal, written rescission offer.
Right. A rescission offer is a legally binding attempt to settle. It is basically Dave saying, my bad. Here is a formal offer to buy the stock back from you for the original purchase price plus interest right now. Take this check and we don't need to involve the lawyers.
It sounds like a pretty good deal for Kathy. She gets her money back without the hassle of a trial. But there is a massive trap here involving a 30-day silence rule. Break this down for us.
If Dave sends a legally compliant rescission offer, the clock immediately starts ticking for Kathy. If Kathy still owns the security and she receives this letter and she just ignores it, let's say she puts it in a kitchen drawer, goes on a long vacation, and forgets about it. If she stays silent for 30 days, she loses her right to sue.
Wait, silence strips her of her legal rights?
Yes. The logic of the law is that Dave offered to make her perfectly whole, exactly as the court would. If she refuses to accept the money within 30 days, she cannot clog up the judicial system 2 years later with a lawsuit demanding the exact same amount. Her failure to act acts as a forfeiture of her right to bring a civil action.
That is wild. You have to respond. But what if she already panics hold the security at a loss? Dave still sends her a rescission offer, offering to cover the cash difference between what she lost and what she paid. Does silence screw her over then, too?
No, and this is the vital nuance the exam tests. If she no longer owns the security, the rule flips. In that case, she must affirmatively reject the offer in writing within 30 days in order to preserve her right to sue.
Let me make sure I have this straight. Scenario one, she still owns it. She must accept the offer within 30 days or she loses the right to sue. Silence is deadly.
Right.
Scenario two, she already sold it. She must reject the offer in writing within 30 days to keep her right to sue.
You've got it. The key takeaway for the listener is that when a rescission offer arrives in the mail, the buyer has a strict 30-day window where they must take action or their legal options fundamentally change.
Okay, we are entering the final stretch. Section 7, go directly to jail. We are talking about criminal penalties. We have talked about Administrator Al taking Dave's license. That's administrative. We have talked about Clueless Kathy taking Dave's money. That's civil. Now we are talking about the state attorney general taking Dave's actual freedom.
Criminal penalties are the absolute top tier of consequences. And unlike administrative or civil actions, which can sometimes happen by mistake or negligence, criminal penalties require a very specific mental state. The violation must be willful.
Willful. Let's define that word carefully, because Dave is standing in front of a criminal court judge right now, tears streaming down his face, and he is saying, Your Honor, I swear on my life I didn't know I was breaking the law. I didn't mean to commit a crime. I just didn't read the rule book. Does that defense work?
No, it does not. Under the Uniform Securities Act, willfully has a very specific and relatively low bar.
Okay.
It simply means Dave was aware of what he was doing physically.
Mm-hmm.
He intentionally performed the act. He intentionally picked up the phone. He intentionally pushed the button to execute the trade.
So it does not require him to know that the act was illegal?
Exactly. Ignorance of the law is no excuse. Willful does not require evil intent. It does not require an intent to defraud. It just means you meant to do the action you did. It wasn't an accident. You didn't trip over a power cord and accidentally execute a block trade on your keyboard.
Wow. So if I intentionally sell security to Kathy, and I genuinely, honestly believed in my heart that it was exempt from registration, but I was wrong, I'm still acting willfully because I meant to sell it.
Yes, you willfully made the sale. If the sale turns out to be illegal, you are criminally liable.
That's scary.
Now, there is one very specific, very narrow exception regarding prison time for rules and orders. If you violate a specific administrative rule or a specific order from Al Jund, not the core anti-fraud law itself, but a technical rule. You cannot be sent to prison if you can prove you had no knowledge of that specific rule or order.
So I can still be fined, my license can be revoked, Kathy can still sue me, but the state will not physically lock me in a cage if I can prove I had zero knowledge of that obscure rule.
Correct. But proving you had absolutely no knowledge of a rule in an industry where you are professionally licensed and required to pass exams is incredibly difficult.
I bet. I didn't know it was a tough sell for a professional. Okay, let's talk numbers. Let's do a side-by-side comparison of the criminal penalties under the state-level Uniform Securities Act versus the federal-level Investment Advisors Act of 1940. Because the exam expects you to know both sets of numbers, and they will absolutely try to make you mix them up.
Let's start with the state level, the USA. We have great memory aid for this. Mm-hmm. Think of the numbers 553.
553. Let's break down what those stand for. Dave is going to state court.
The first five is the maximum monetary fine, $5,000 per violation.
Okay, $5,000.
The second five is the criminal statute of limitations. The state prosecutor has 5 years from the date of the alleged violation to indict you.
5 years.
And the three is the maximum prison sentence. 3 years in state prison per violation.
So $5,000 fine, 5 year limit to charge you, 3 years in state prison, 553. Notice that all the numbers for the state level are five or under.
Right. Now compare that to the federal penalties. Let's say Dave committed his fraud after he got promoted to that SEC registered firm. And the federal government is coming after him under the Investment Advisors Act of 1940. The federal numbers are bigger.
Federal government, bigger budgets, bigger penalties. Dave is going to federal court.
Exactly. Under the IAA of 1940, the maximum fine jumps to $10,000. And the maximum federal prison sentence is 5 years.
So state is $5,000, 3 years. Federal is $10,000, 5 years. If an exam question asks you specifically about the maximum penalty under the Uniform Securities Act, the state law, and one of the multiple choice answers is $10,000 and 5 years in prison, you know instantly that is a trap. They are trying to trick you with the federal numbers.
Correct. You have to read the question carefully to see which jurisdiction they're asking about. Stick to 553 for the USA.
Awesome. We have covered a massive amount of ground today. We have followed Dave from a coffee shop to an interrogation room to civil court and finally to a state prison cell.
Quite the journey.
Let's move into our outro with a rapid fire recap. Let's cement these highly testable takeaways right now. Listeners, see if you can answer these before the expert does. Ready?
Ready. Let's do it.
Administrator powers versus court powers. The difference.
Administrator issues cease and desist orders and revokes registrations. Courts issue injunctions, order restitution, and sentence people to prison.
The three triggers for jurisdiction over an offer.
Origin, directed to or accepted in.
Yeah.
Any one of the three triggers full jurisdiction. Residency does not matter.
The two-prong test for denying a registration.
The action must be in the public interest, Andy say. There must be a specific statutory ground.
The 10-year criminal trap regarding statutory grounds.
Any felony counts if it's within 10 years. But for misdemeanors, it must involve securities or the securities business.
The civil statute of limitations.
3 years from the sale or 2 years from discovery, whichever comes first.
And finally, criminal penalties under the Uniform Securities Act.
The 553 rule, $5,000 fine, 5 year statute of limitations, 3 years in prison.
Boom. That is pure high yield exam material right there. Now, before we sign off, I promise to leave you with a final provocative thought. We talked a lot about Administrator Al dropping the hammer on Dave's license, but we left out what happens immediately after. There is a process called judicial review.
Yes. Let's say Administrator Al revokes Dave's registration.
Yeah.
Dave thinks Al was completely unfair, maybe misapplied the two-prong test. Dave has the right to appeal Al's decision to a real court. The rule is that Dave has to file a written petition for appeal within 60 days of Al's order being entered.
60 days to file the appeal. But here is the kicker and the thought I want you to mull over as you study. Does Dave get to keep working, keep selling securities, and keep making a living while the court takes months or even years to decide his appeal?
No. Filing an appeal does not automatically stay or pause the administrator's order.
Let that sink in. Administrator Al, essentially a local bureaucrat, signs a piece of paper, and Dave's career is instantly frozen. Even if Dave immediately appeals the next morning, the revocation is active and in full force until a judge specifically steps in and orders a stay. Think about how much unilateral power that gives the state administrator over someone's entire livelihood. It's immense.
It is immense, which is exactly why the law requires that strict two-prong test and all those due process notifications, like the 15-day hearing rule. The power is huge, so the procedural guardrails have to be strictly followed by the state.
Absolutely. Well, that wraps up our deep dive into remedies and administrative provisions. We hope following Dave, Al, and Kathy made the legal jargon a little less dry and a lot more sticky in your brain. When you sit down for your exam and you see a question about jurisdiction or cease and desist, just close your eyes and picture devious Dave sweating on the tri-state border, clueless Kathy holding her worthless stock, and Administrator Al blowing his mall cop whistle. You've got this. Good luck on the Series 65 exam, and we will see you on the next deep dive.